Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello and welcome to a brand new series of Rahalastapa, today with Angela Barnes, recorded in Brighton. And funny enough, we're back out on the road for the next series, which is being recorded now. And we're back in Brighton on the 15th of September at the Brighton Theatre Royal. It'd be lovely if everyone who came to see those two gigs in Brighton would come to that one. We've got Simon Evans and To Be Confirmed. And then I'm out on the road all autumn. I'm in Leicester on the 19th of September, Bristol Old Vic on the 22nd of September, very close to selling out, Richmond Theatre in London on the 29th of September, then Winchester, Exeter, a couple of gigs in Newcastle. There's some Leicester Square Theatre gigs as well coming up. And onwards it goes. Go to richthang.com/rahalastapata/tour or richthang.com/gigs to find out about that. We've got Rachel Paris coming up, Tate Face, Grayson Perry and Connie Huck and Limmy in Glasgow on the 24th of November, which is already selling extremely quickly. Be lovely to see you at one of those gigs. Do support the podcast if you can. We've got enough in the can to take us up to December, but it will carry on weekly for a very long time. This is about a year's worth just from this tour. So thanks very much. Sit back, relax and enjoy. Rahalastapata. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Old Market in Hove. Please welcome a man who is wearing his wedding suit and has just remembered why he hasn't worn this for 5 years. It's Richard Herring! Thank you very much, hello! Hello, Hove! Welcome to the show. This is Richard Herring's Let's Start Trampolining podcast. It's a new podcast where I'm just going to try and start trampolining with the guests at the beginning, see how it works out. You've got to have a gimmick these days. There's so many podcasts, you've got to get a new gimmick. But I was hanging out on the British Airways i360 that has lost £3.8 million this year and a third
It's got a third of the visitors have gone. It's gone down a third number of visitors. There was two other people on there, and they called it Rahalastapa. So I don't know. I don't know if that's gonna catch on. I was quite interested in. I haven't been on actually, really, in real life, the British Airways I-360. It's like the London Eye, but it's not as good. I went on TripAdvisor to read the one-star reviews of it, which, to be fair, aren't the majority. But one of them said, "If I wanted a view as a soaring bird, I'd fly. If I want ascending thrill from height, I'd visit the Eiffel Tower." I mean, not if you're in Brighton, though, mate. Come on, be fair. And then somebody else says, similar to the London Eye, "You'll not come in your pants, but enjoyable in its own way." I mean, if you're expecting to come in your pants on a tourist attraction, your expectations are too high. That was a one-star review. I didn't come in my pants at all. Had to get my penis out and masturbate myself to orgasm. And we are in Hove, of course, beautiful Hove, which you'll know has a very funny motto at the town of Hove. We wish we were proper Brighton, but at least we're not Port Slade Village. So that's their funny. Right, I'm not going to do too much messing around at the start because we're pressed for time. This is a bonus extra show we put in because of the huge demand. If you're listening in the Brighton area, I'll be back on the 15th of September at the Theatre Royal. My guest this week is probably best known for her appearance on The Body Shocking Show. That's why we're all here to see it. Will you please welcome Angela Barnes, ladies and gentlemen? Come in.
Hello.
Hello.
Ah. The Body Shocking Show, I remember
that. What was The Body Shocking Show?
It was on Channel 5, so it was obviously brilliant. it was a show about people who'd done insane things to their bodies. So people who'd... the one that sticks in my mind, it was a long time ago, there was a guy who'd had his Achilles heel pierced.
Okay.
And it got so badly wrong, he ended up in a wheelchair, and it was really hard to feel sorry for him. It was really hard. But I remember sitting down with the director beforehand, and they were sort of showing us the clips of things that we were going to look at, we had to talk about. And it was people who'd had weird piercings, and it was this Japanese craze of... they're called bagel heads. I don't know if you... Well, they inject... I think it's like saline solution into their foreheads to make their foreheads look like bagels.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And then she just flipped over to the next one, and it was Angelina Jolie's knees. And she said, "Look, has she got saggy knees?" It's like, "What? Fuck off! Like, she's allowed to have saggy knees. She's a woman in her 40s. I'm not taking the piss out of that. She hasn't done that to herself."
You know, You should have walked out there and then.
I should have done, but I needed the money, Rich.
Yeah, fair enough. You know. So, you know, you've had an amazing rise to success. I came and did a gig for you when you were
Before I started doing stand-up.
Before you were doing stand-up, and it feels like only yesterday that was. And
yeah,
now look at you.
2008. It was great. I remember it was when you were doing Hitler Moustache.
Right.
And you came and did a preview at the Farm Tavern in Hove, just down the road from here. I used to run a little night called The Funny Farm in the tiny little room upstairs, and we somehow... contravening all health and safety rules, got about 65 people in that room. And you were testing out for the first night, I remember, the little Hitler moustaches that you gave people at end.
Yeah.
But it was the first time you'd done it. You bought ones that gave everyone a rash.
Yes, yeah.
And so by the end, everyone did have a Hitler moustache that they couldn't get rid of for about a week.
It was a deliberate move on my part. Luckily, I never got sued. I think at the end we used, Velcro. I just got a lot of Velcro tape that we cut up.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah, some people still had an allergic reaction to that. Just went, yeah, bad luck. It was the good old days of the 2000s. You'd get away with all sorts back then. You'd give people terrible. And so, were you planning at that point to do stand-up, or was that...
No, not at all. It was... that would have been 2008, and my dad died that year in the summer. Very suddenly, and he used to come to all the shows. He was at your show probably, and used to come along.
It wasn't the moustache that killed him.
Yeah, it was actually. I thought I'd wait till now to tell you, Rich. I brought my lawyer, and he always used to say, "Well, you know, you'd love. Why don't you get up and have a go?" And I was like, "Oh, don't be stupid. I couldn't do that." Then after he died, I just thought, "Life's short, isn't it?" He was 60, right. You know, it's no age really. And so I signed up. I did the Jill Edwards comedy course here in Brighton at Comedia. And I thought, well, I'll give it a go there. Because the problem was, because I was booking a comedy night, I knew loads of comedians. So I didn't want to go out there and make a complete arse of myself in front of people I knew. So I thought, I'll do a little course. That'd be a safe way to do it. And that was that.
It's amazing. Well, I remember because I heard you. It was 2011, the new actor, the BBC new actor.
Yeah, 2011.
I was whatever tour that was. I was driving around and driving home from gigs when that was on. So I was right. Kind of cheering you on through the stages of that,
and then
you kind of ended up winning, which was fantastic. So that was obviously the big break to win the.
I mean, I wasn't supposed to win that. I was in a final with Joe Lycett, for fuck's sake. And it was really funny because it was live on Radio 2, and I'm hard of hearing, right? So I wear hearing aids, and I was backstage. So very often, if I'm backstage, I can't hear what's going on stage. And they didn't have a relay at the venue we were in, and Patrick Keelty was hosting it, and it was live on air. And they announced the winner, and I just shook Joe's hand and went, "Well done, mate." And he's like, "It's you, you silly bitch." And pushed me out. And I was like, "Oh, there's a video on YouTube somewhere." But I came out, I tripped over a mic cable. Just so wasn't supposed to happen.
Well, it's great. And so, was part of that getting like a radio show, or was it?
No, I mean, the year after that, they introduced that as part of the prize. I didn't even get any money, mate. I got a lump of Perspex and a well done. That's what I got. But no, I did that, and because I didn't have an agent or anything then, I'd only been an open spot for about 18 months. So I didn't actually start properly till 2010.
Yeah.
And so then I had agents sort of getting in touch, and it was like, oh Christ, this is real now. I still had a day job.
Yeah.
You know, so I sort of took it from there.
Because it's what strikes me, and especially with your generation of that generation of stand-ups, it's so difficult to get your head above that parapet, really. And there's so many people trying to do stand-up.
Yeah.
So it's quite a rare story for someone to go, right, I'll start doing comedy in 2009, and then I'll be on the radio in 2011, and...
Look, as far as I shouldn't really bring up another podcast, but I did, when I was still sort of early on, just after I won it, I did Stu Goldsmith's Comedians Comedian podcast. We recorded an episode.
Right.
And he was like, I can't put this out. It gives people too much hope. He was like, open spots, listen to this. They're going to be like, oh, it's easy. You start and 18 months later you win a thing and then it's all fine. It's like, no, it's not like that.
But it isn't like that. So it's
I think that. I was 33 when I started doing stand-up. Yeah. So I think, you know, in my head I was a bit, right, I've got to get on with this, you know, because I'm not 20. And that's the weird thing. You say my generation of stand-up. I'm in a really weird position because the people that are in what I call my school year of stand-ups, you know, that started at the same time as me, most of them are a decade or more younger than me.
Yeah.
Whereas the people that are my age are sort of a decade or more ahead of the game than me. So I'm in this weird sort of middle ground of not being one of the cool young kids, but also not being an old... Yes. You know, oh God, so yeah.
It's weird, because in my mind, I kind of would still place you in with that generation. But I similarly, because I came back to stand up in 2004, really, and I did stand up very early on, but then I kind of didn't want to do it on my own.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of affiliated with that guy. Russell Howard was just sort of getting big, you know, on the circuit at that point when I started. So that I've got the same thing from this much older guy who came back to school.
Up and take him home, you know. <It's>,
But yeah, it's interesting to see, and it is sort of remarkable that someone can break through. I often just think I wouldn't, if I was starting now, I wouldn't.
No. Well, I think even in the last 5 years, it's changed, you know, because when I started, you didn't have, you know, 10 years ago, 9 years ago, whatever, you didn't have YouTube stars then really, or, you know, there's so many people just making their own content. Podcasts weren't as big as they are now. And now everyone can make their own content and put it out there. And actually, I feel like a dinosaur that I don't know where to start with that stuff. So I think in some ways, if I'd left it any later, I would have had to go.
But it's good to, you know, I think when I started doing stand-up, there was lots of people who had a life experience and then come back to it. So there were guys who'd worked on the docks, and there was guys who'd worked, you know, in like jobs as lawyers or doctors or whatever, and then become stand-ups. Yeah. And now a lot of 20-year-olds are starting doing stand-up, which is sort of what I was doing, I suppose. Yeah. But you don't have any life experience.
Well, I wonder how relatable, like you, when you're 20, you're sort of relatable to other 20-year-olds to a certain extent. But, you know, how much is, oh, I was at another gig and I, you know, was on another bus, a train, or I was on a, you know, on the M6 on a Friday night. You're like, well, most 20-year-olds aren't doing that. You know, so it does make you wonder. I'm quite glad I had some stuff in the bank to bring to it, you know, to talk
about.
And
you don't know who you are, do you, when you're 20, really? Anyone 20 in here? Probably not.
Of course not. Look at them.
You don't know, you know. I remember. I don't. Well, no comedian knows who they are. So they're pretending to be someone else. But I should say that I didn't mention the reason I was worried. Just in case anything happens, the reason I was suddenly worried about wearing the suit is I remembered the last time I stopped wearing it because the fly just kept on coming down. So I just like to. Angela,
he warned me about that in the dressing room, and I was like, are you just preempting your Me Too moment right now?
If my penis pops out, it's not... If I don't come during a podcast, I am always
disappointed. I'm 42, I'll take what I can get, Richard.
Just in my pants, it's all in that... If they can't stop you coming in your pants, can they, mate? They can't stop that. On your own, not touching anyone, not just on your own. When they stop that, then we're in trouble, aren't we? Some booze there from the people who don't want that stopped, I think, is there. Okay, is my only inference. I can't remember who I was talking to. It might have been Professor Alice Roberts, or it might have been one of the no such thing as a fish guys, mm-hmm. who told me you're an expert on nuclear bunkers.
Expert's a strong word. Well, I've got a little obsession with nuclear bunkers. I love concrete things.
Right.
I think when I grew up, you know, in the 70s and 80s, when I was a kid, everything was made of concrete. My school was, the block of flats I lived in, what our playgrounds were, you know, everything was. So that sort of real nostalgia of concrete thing. And then when I discovered that there were 1,500 nuclear bunkers in this country, I wanted to find them.
Right.
And I've done gigs in them. There's some massive ones out there. I mean, I could nerd on about this for eight. I was a bit worried being nerdy, but then I looked at you. It's going to be fine, isn't it? It'll
be all right. How many have you been in of the 1,500 nuclear bunkers?
Oh, I must have been at least 20. Yeah. Some of them are derelict now and you can't get in. But I find them all the time because they're sort of dotted along the countryside. I went, my fella is not interested in them at all. But he loves a country walk. And we, every year in Edinburgh, we go, on my day off, he'll book a little surprise B&B out in the countryside somewhere. And we'll go out and, you know, and we went out on this ramble and I just literally just rambled across a nuclear bunker in the undergrowth. I just spotted the ventilation shaft. He's like, oh, for fuck's sake, you can't even go on a country walk without you just finding a nuclear bunker.
What do you think? Are you worried? Are you concerned about nuclear war? Or...
Oh, no. I mean, this isn't I don't love them because I think I'm going to head to one if the worst happens. If the worst happens, I'm going to head to ground zero. That's because, you know, life after a nuclear war, it's not going to be... No, just get it done. Yeah. Get it done. Cyanide pill, whatever. Yeah.
Well, are there none of the bunkers that you think this would be a nice place to...
Have you been in one?
No, I haven't been. I've never been in one.
No, I think... they've got sort of dormitories, you know, so even the big ones, it's... You sleep... And they don't have... So they're built for 400 people, but they've only got, like, 100 beds. So you do a hot bed system. So... Yeah, this isn't putting you off, is it? Yeah. Just means the bedding never gets washed. As soon as one person gets out, you get in.
Four people in a bed, that's all right. That's all right. You have to repopulate the earth. That's what I'm thinking. So you did do a show about how to survive a nuclear apocalypse, didn't you, on the radio with John?
Oh, Robbins. No, I did a thing on Radio 4 about Cold War secrets, and I had John Robbins came on and we talked about... he's obsessed with... He's like a... More on the prepper end of things, you know, nut job. Yeah, I love him, but he's a nut job. And, so we talked about his plans for surviving nuclear apocalypse. And I sort of thought he was joking when he says on his radio show that he'd planned it. He's not. We had to cut so much out. It was, he knows what to... In fact, if you're wondering what to do in a nuclear apocalypse, follow John Robbins. He knows where he's going and what he's doing.
There isn't very long, though, is there, between finding out it's happening? Do you think they would tell us if it was about to happen, or do you think...
I don't know. Like, back in the Cold War, you know, you had the four-minute warning was the thing. But now, weapons are so much more advanced than they were then.
But even if they had 4 minutes, I don't think they'd tell us.
I don't think they would.
What's the point?
Yeah. What are you going to do in that 4 minutes? I know what you'd do in that 4 minutes, but what are you going to do in the other 3 minutes? sorry, that was cheap. I'm sorry.
It's all right. Cheap's good. I'm going to ask you an emergency question straight at the back because, these people have come to a tour show.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go early in the book because, this is old school for the provinces. the provinces of the provinces, let's face it, we're in Hove. So, would you rather be a cow or a badger?
I'd rather be a badger, got better hair.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good answer.
And underneath this, I look like a badger under the red pretty much now. Yeah, it's definitely black and white stripes in there.
Have you ever seen a ghost?
Never, because they don't exist, Rich.
I just heard one.
Shit. I really want to. That's the thing. My tour support, Phil Gerrard,
Yeah, he's a ghost.
Is he here? No. He is absolutely desperate to see a ghost, but doesn't believe in them. But he's desperate to see one. Yeah, and wherever we go, if we go into a really old theatre, while I'm on stage doing my show, he'll come back up and he'll show me where he's gone under the stage and filmed. And like, can you see anything? Can you see? It's like, no, Phil, because they don't exist.
But there often are in theatres, aren't there? So, you know, yeah. Traditionally.
I went to the only place I felt a little bit eerie, but I think it was just, I went to the Winter Gardens in Morecambe, which was the venue where Eric Morecambe started, and Laurel and Hardy played there. It's a derelict shell now because somebody in the 70s burnt it down as an insurance job. And John Richardson, being a Morecambe local, is part of, they're trying to restore it, but it's taken a long time. And he, every year, does a big show there. And they basically, it's sort of, there's no roof on it, but they just hire in a load of seats and do it to raise money for a hospice. And I did it one year, and they took, it was me and him and Matt Ford, they took us sort of on the little tour and took us underneath the stage. And I think it was actually just that Matt Ford was really winding us up. It was what was actually happening. But that's the only time I've ever gone a bit like, oh, this is a bit eerie.
I'd imagine Matt Ford is terrified of ghosts. I don't know if I asked him. He's just scaredy cat.
Yeah, it's all mouth.
He'd just be in your mouth because he'd be going, why if I see a ghost, I'll poo myself.
Yeah. Have you seen a ghost?
No, they don't exist.
Yeah.
This is a good question. Number six, I don't ask this very often. Isn't silver actually better than gold?
Yeah, I hate gold. It's tacky.
Yeah. Silver's way better than gold.
Yeah, but don't tell them that because then they'll charge us more. I love gold. Keep the gold expensive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. I think you've worked out there. All right, I'm going to go on page one. Oh, it's not the question I thought it would be. That's lucky because that wouldn't have worked. Would you prefer to have a hand made out of ham? Just playing to the crowds.
I see what you've done there.
Or an armpit that dispensed sun cream. I don't do it very often, so enjoy it. I'm not going to give the second audience that pleasure. Don't you worry about that. Fuck them. Apart from the ones who come into both.
The really sad thing about this is I know that question. I already know my answer before you even ask it. It's definitely the armpit that because I don't eat meat. So.
Yeah, but you could eat meat. That's the thing. So you could eat your own hand because no animal dies for it, and it grows back, so you still have hands.
I get it, but I also burn very easily. I've got very pale skin. You're looking at me because of a story I know you're going to bring up, but I do sunburn really easily. And so if I could have factor 50, would it be factor... Like, it'd have to be a high factor sun cream.
You choose the factor, but then you can't
change
the factor.
That would save me so much money because I can't leave the house in the summer without covering myself. My mum said to me once, she went, oh, yeah, you do burn easily, so you redheads do, don't you? It's not my natural hair colour. You gave birth to me, mum, remember? You're right, when I got my hair dyed, it was a mistake to get the matching skin graft. You're right, yeah. Brilliant.
So, talking of skin being burnt...
Yes.
Your skin has been burnt recently.
It has.
I'm brilliant at this. Brilliant at this job. Come on, that was good. You liked it. Both of them are... I think I might have seen two ghosts in the front row. What happened?
So, I had a bit of an accident with a hot water bottle... and got third-degree burns on my tits. So I'm not going to show you my tits. I'll show you just the bit there is still quite red. It was about 6 weeks ago now that I did it, but that's the bit that's not badly burnt. The bit that is it's pretty grim. Only I could get third-degree burns on my tits. It's a pretty... I mean, I did think, well, I'm going to get at least 10 minutes out of this. So.
Yeah, well, it's always the thing as a comedian. Yeah. However bad it is, even in the moment...
Yeah.
You're thinking, oh, yeah.
It was so... The whole thing was so... I mean, it was so insane. I was at home on my own when it happened, and I was pouring the boiling water into the hot water bottle, which apparently you're not supposed to do, but everyone does. And it just sort of gurgled and fountained up. But it went over my face as well, so all I could think, we're not the face. So I put a cold tap on and put my head under for about 10 minutes, and it was then I realised that I was wearing a jumper and it had soaked through. Ooh. So I took the jumper off, got myself in a cold shower. Now, I used to be a nurse, right? So I know sort of what to do. And but I was at home on my own. I knew I needed to get to A&E. I knew it was that bad. Right. But I knew I couldn't drive myself there. And I didn't want to call an ambulance because I could walk. And so, and my boyfriend was on his way home from work, so he's going to be another hour. So I actually, I phoned my boyfriend, who then phoned Phil Gerrard, who lives not far. So he came, he's my hero that night. He came and picked me up, bless him. And, but by this time, I'd come out of the shower and I'd wrapped myself in cling film, because that's what you're supposed to do with a burn, because it's sterile and doesn't have any bits that can get in a burn. So I wrapped myself with cling film, put a dressing gown on, And Phil turned up. And, you know, I'm not looking my best, I think it's fair to say. And puts me in the car. We drove up to A&E and it was absolutely rammed. You know, it was a Tuesday night, but it was so rammed. It's almost like the government are trying to destroy the NHS. And I went up there and this never, ever happens to me. Right? I'm not somebody who gets recognised. I'm not on telly enough for that to happen. And I am... if you know the Royal Sussex Hospital, I was up there and the reception is right in the waiting room and it's rammed, right? And I walk in and the receptionist, I've got my tits wrapped in cling film, I'm soaking wet wearing a dressing gown, and the receptionist went, "You're on Mock the Week, aren't you?" And the whole waiting room just went, "What?" I could look at Phil Gerrard was just pissing himself, and it was like, it just, that never happened. Why now? So yeah, that happened. And, yeah.
Will you recover fully, or is
I'll probably have some scars. Yeah. So I had to go up to the Burns unit at East Grinstead, and I've sort of been treated by them, and they are brilliant. So if anyone from the Burns unit at East Grinstead is listening, thank you. But, I mean, it's all very undignified, because it's literally, the burns are on my, across my nipples.
Yeah. Right?
And the worst one, I mean, I have to do this to show you, but the worst one's sort of down, it's like in the shape of a Nike swoosh. She's improved my sex life no end. It really has. It puts the idea of just do it into my boyfriend's head. But because the scar tissue's so thick, the nurse was like, she had to show me how to massage it to stop it scarring too much. It was like, you've got to massage it for 10 minutes a day.
Sure.
This, I mean, I can't be orgasming for 10 minutes a day. I've got shit to do. Yeah, so that's really dignified. I feel really dignified when I get out of a shower and massage E45 cream into my tits for 10 minutes.
Do you think the burns unit people slightly resent the fact that your burn isn't really a proper burn?
Yeah.
From a hot water bottle. I mean, people have come in with proper, been in fires, accidents.
Well, a friend of mine, I don't know,
plane
do you know
crashes.
There's a comedian, Benji Waterhouse, I don't know if you right. know, he's a psychiatrist, qualified, right. But he's got a friend that he did his medical training with, who is now a plastic surgeon who specialises in hot water bottle burns. It's that common, yeah. So I'm just lucky I didn't need a skin graft or anything, but apparently it's really... I mean, mine are in the bin. Put them in the bin. Get yourself one of those little lavender heat packs, put in the microwave.
You're going to have to do, like, a public information film
well,
about the dangers.
Jeremy Vine's people got in touch. Do you want to come on Jeremy Vine's show? Do I look like Lynn Fallswood? No, I don't want to... I don't want to be the voice of burnt tits. I don't
this could be it.
Need that in my life. So
yeah. This could be your man draw. This could be it.
So, yeah, I'll just if everyone here tells a friend not to use a hot water bottle, then we'll get the message out that way without me having to debase myself on Radio 2.
Well, it's interesting because my guest, I'm also talking to in Brighton, Stephen Grant, has been in a terrible bike accident.
Yeah.
So we've got two scarred, permanently yeah. scarred guests.
He'll tell you about his scar,
yeah,
but he's done a great thing with his scar. So.
Okay, well, yeah, I'll definitely will ask him about
there
that.
There we are.
It must be very exciting for you to be... you're now regular on the news quiz and you're on shows like Mock the Week.
Yeah.
And I know you were a big fan of the news quiz and Linda Smith, especially before you were a comedian yourself. So that's got to be pretty exciting to get to that.
It's so surreal because I remember when I won the New Comedy Award in 2011 and I did an interview with Chortle and... I did an interview with Chortle and they said, you know, if you win, what's your biggest ambition? And everyone else in the final was sort of said to be on Live at the Apollo or to, you know, I was like, I want to be on the news quiz. And that week, a producer from the news quiz contacted me and asked if I wanted to do some writing on it, which, right. as far as I was concerned, that meant I'd made it. I did a day, you know, writing on the news quiz. That was fine. And then a few years later, I finally got to be a panelist on it. And it's just, I mean, it's insane. I sit there. You know, and God bless him, I'd very often be sat next to Jeremy Hardy. And I just couldn't believe where, you know, being treated like one of the gang. You know, they even called the seat next to Jeremy, they started calling it Barnsley's seat because I'm deaf in my right ear. They sit me with my left ear to the host.
Right.
So, you know, started calling it Barnsley's seat. And I just, it's insane that I'm part of that. I keep expecting the tap on the shoulder. It's been a terrible mistake. You're not a comedian. But it hasn't come
it's
yet.
It's quite a tough show to do. I've done it a couple of times, and it's not my forte, I don't think. But it's because it's coming up with the... Obviously, you get a bit of chance to prepare. Well, you know what the news is anyway, so you can prepare.
Yeah.
You can prepare in any case, but you get a little bit of a nudge in what's going to come up. But so you just... How much time do you spend? Because I thought, I'll just wing this and say...
My agent always says about me, Barnsley does her homework.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a proper... I like to prepare things, and I'm not a natural improviser. So I like to know what I'm going in something like that.
Yeah.
You know, have an idea of what my thoughts are, and also I'm terrified of saying something that could be taken the wrong way or get myself in trouble. You know. So I do like to know roughly what I'm going to say, and you know, have a couple of gags in my head. For, yeah. But you know, it's been hard the last couple of years because if I have to write one more fucking joke about Brexit,
you're
going
to have to write a lot, more,
gonna
jokes
write a lot more jokes about Brexit. It's so tedious. It's so tedious. And when I was doing News Jack, you know, you can't win because you'd, you know, every week, particularly my first episode of News Jack that I hosted was the day that Donald Trump was inaugurated. Like, so I sort of went through that first 2 years and, and every week, obviously, it'd be Brexit and Trump, Brexit and Trump. They were the main stories in the headlines, and you couldn't win, because if you didn't do it, people would go, well, you're not doing the main stories. If you did do it, it's, oh, not this fucking... But you're like, well, I can't help what's going on in the world, you know? It's just, it's so tedious.
But you're very good at... I saw you do... I saw a clip of the roast battle you did.
Oh, yeah.
I love that. Very strong joke, because a lot of those, it's, you know, people who know each other quite well. I'm not saying you don't know, but who just are picking on personal stuff, but you kind of got really nailed that with
thanks. I really enjoyed it. Matt and I are good friends.
Yeah.
So although Matt Richardson is years younger than me, he's like my comedy little brother, because we started at the same time. And in fact, in 2012, we did a two-hander at the Edinburgh Festival together. So we are really close. And I was really nervous about doing roast battle, because it's not really my thing, you know, just to be mean to people for the sake of it. And then they'd asked Matt to do it. And Matt basically said, I'll do it if I can do it with Angela. I'm like, oh, okay. And I was quite nervous, but we sat down and we just sort of had a, you know, where our red lines were.
Yeah.
So you can mention my dead dad, whatever, that's fine, but not this. And, you know, and then we went away. And I knew, and he knew, that we're both quite thick-skinned. Like, you'd have to work really hard for him to actually upset me.
Yeah.
So we could really have fun with it. And because I think that show would be really hard to do. I know some people do it with people they barely know, yeah. And I just couldn't do that. Like, I needed to know I was safe and that, you know, we gave each other a big hug as soon as it was over and it was all fine. But it was a lot of fun. And also because I don't really do much dark or horrible stuff. It was really nice to be able to delve into that bit. You know, you can't do that on the News Quiz.
No. You know? But, you know, you're very good at the... I mean, I'm not good at gags. I know you... I heard you when you did get interviewed by Stuart and it went out. You know, you work very hard writing pages of stuff to get some jokes. I, you know, if I write one gag a year... I'm very happy with that.
I wish I could be more freewheeling. I do. It comes from a place of anxiety because I think I said this on Stu's podcast, I'm so nervous that the next laugh's not going to come. I just have to pack it with as many gags as I can to give it a chance for, because, you know, the longer they're not laughing, the more I'm sweating. And
but if you can do it, if you can, you know, you are topping all the time. You create a joke and you top it and top it and top it. And then that gets that lovely, if people are laughing at something and then something else makes them laugh, that's as a comedian, that's a great thing to happen. Yeah. As an audience member, it's great just to get to that point where you're sort of slightly helpless with laughter because too many jokes are coming at once. Doesn't happen in my show. So you're safe with me from that. It's one of my main selling points. Well, let's talk about your dad a little bit, because I know you've done a show, again, partly about your dad.
And yeah.
Your dad was quite a character.
That is the word that everyone uses. Yeah, a pervert, I think, is the word. I love my dad, but he was not a conventional dad.
No.
I mean, I say that, he was to me. Like, you know, he was actually quite prudish of me. I was his little girl, you know. Yeah. But he ran a sex shop for a living. He was a swinger. Very liberal.
Yeah.
You know, free love and all that. Child of the 60s, whatever. But, yeah, and so I never had a... I mean, my parents divorced when I was 9. And I don't know how they were ever married to each other. They're so different. And my mum's lovely, but just quite, she came, you know, from a big Catholic family. She's one of 9 and quite sheltered.
Yeah.
And I think they just got married young. And then my dad discovered this other world. And my mum was, not really on board with that, I think it's fair to say. So he went off and had his fun, you know. And I always say about my dad, I love him dearly. He was the best dad in the world. Shitty husband, but a brilliant dad, you know. And yeah. we were best mates. We were really close. Because, you know, he was still my dad. He was still my, you know, growing up, he didn't give a shit about anything, but he knew how to have fun and knew. And I think consequently, because I was never pushed, there was never any pressure to do well because my dad had dropped out of school. My mum didn't finish school with any exams. So anything I did was a bonus, you know. And the fact I went to university was, well, that was enough for them to be, you know, they didn't need me to do any more. And it just meant I didn't have any pressure. And so I learned about fun with my dad. And in fact, it was the other way around. Like, I was the nerdy. He used to call me Lisa Simpson.
Right.
And I remember one night I was in a pub. I was about 16, 17, and I was in a pub with my friends doing a bit of underage drinking like you do. And my dad knew which pub I'd gone to. And him and his friends were doing a charity pub crawl that night. And my dad was dressed as Homer Simpson. And he like promised me he wouldn't come into the pub. He knew I was going to be in with my... Of course he did. Of course he came in there. And I just went straight out into the loos and hid from him. People kept coming, "Your dad's in there, he's brilliant." And I was just going, "This is fucking going to kill him." But his whole life was about humiliating me. He loved it. He used to do things like... it's a true story. When I was 14, so he was a type 1 diabetic. So he used to inject himself twice a day. He had been since he was a small child. And he used hypodermic needles, right? He couldn't get on with the modern newfangled pen things. So he'd always have hypodermics. And when I was 14, him and my mum used to alternate going to my parents' evenings at school. And I was a really studious child. That was my way of rebelling, was to be a good girl, you know, studious. And he'd gone to my parents' evening and had this form tutor, Mrs. Wren. She was lovely. She was a textiles teacher and very lovely. And he went round to all my teachers. And he said to me before he went off, he said, "Oh, these parents' evenings are really boring. They're always blowing smoke up your ass." And off he went. And then he presented my form tutor at the end of the evening with a hypodermic needle and a bit of tinfoil and said, "I found this in Angela's bag. What's it mean?" Yeah. And she was just like, "I don't understand." He was like, "Well, I don't understand. She didn't know him. She didn't know what he was like. And he just played a blinder, didn't ever... But next day I got called in to the head of year. And I had to say, "That's my dad's idea of a joke." You know, and there was a letter sent home. But yeah, that was the sort of thing. He did it to me just before he died. We were up at the marina. My dad loved the marina because he liked looking at all the boats that he'd never be able to afford. And it was Father's Day, 2008. And we'd gone up to the marina to look at the boats. And we went for lunch up there somewhere. And if we were going out for dinner together, I'd put his needles and insulin in my handbag. And we were just leaving the restaurant. And as I stood up, one of his needles fell out of my handbag onto the floor. Packed. It was Father's Day. It was rammed. And my dad just looked at you and went, "You promised me you'd stopped," and stormed out. And just left me in this restaurant. And I had to pick it up and put it back in my bag and leave. God love him.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So you were again on Stuart's podcast. I heard you talking about you were like the best at English and maths in your... You were good at spelling and maths.
Yeah, I was a real little boff at school. Yeah. I was, yeah. And I had to have my own spelling test at primary school. I was that twat who... And my mum says I was like it from... I was dying to learn to read. And I still, to this day, am a voracious reader. I love reading. And my uncle was a headmaster, and he'd said to my mum and dad, "Don't teach her to read before she goes to school, because then they'll teach her in a different way and she'll get confused, you know, wait." So my parents have kept saying to me, "You'll be able to read a book when you go to school." So I thought, day one, I'm going to be able to pick up War and Peace. That's, you know, and apparently I went in and, you know, day one at reception class at primary school, you're just playing with toys. And I apparently stood up and said, well, this is all very well, but where's my book?
Like, when are we learning to read?
Yes,
I've come here to learn to
read. I've come here for a book. That's what I was told. So I've been that kid.
Yeah. I think I was interested in it, though. My dad was my headmaster, so that's
interesting. Yeah.
But, I think that... Well, you talk about it in Stuart's podcast again. It's very good, Stuart's podcast, isn't it? But you talk about that need for, you know, the need for approval and when you get praised.
I'm a praise addict.
Yeah, which
for sure.
is then what leads to being a comedian as well. Yeah. But I was the same. I was very nerdy about studying, and if I got something I liked, I'd rush ahead with it. You know, if there was anything with cards or books that you could work ahead in, I would work all the way to the end.
Yeah. I got like the maths cards you used to get.
Yeah,
like,
SNP cards. Obsessed with those maths cards. And got like to probably, I was about 10 years old and got to O level, A level stuff from those. Because I loved the approval of the teachers.
It's absolutely, and I think it really dawned on me how much of a praise addict I am.
Yeah.
Like, looking back, it's obvious. But as an adult, I learned to swim. I never learned to swim as a child. So about 5 years ago now, I took swimming lessons at Crystal Palace. And I just got into it really quick. Because I had this lovely teacher, Jill, and I realised I was practising because I wanted to please Jill. Like, I didn't want to let her down. And I'd go to my class every week. Look what I can do now, Jill. I did the practice you told me to do. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm that prick. And I guess that's sort of what makes a comic, isn't it? Like, why else would we be up here if we didn't want praise? Yeah. And
you know, no one likes you at school because you're like that, so you have to
find someone. It's so funny. I can't remember who said it, and I think it might have been Stephen Fry, but that thing of... Like, the thing that makes a comic is somebody with crippling low self-esteem plus a desire to show off.
Yeah.
You know, that's such a weird combination of things to have. Because I'm, you know, I suffer from anxiety. I've been hospitalised with anxiety when I was younger. And now I'm doing this. People who knew me at school can't believe that I do this for a living. It's like, well, that girl used to hide behind her hair and wouldn't, you know.
It is an odd, you know, but that's... Sometimes it strikes me when, you know, you're on stage. You know when you're well into a show and you know it and there's a voice in your head that starts trying to fuck you up.
Oh, basically. God, yeah.
But, and says, boy, if you forget how to breathe.
Yeah.
If you forget about that. How to speak.
It's why I can't meditate. Like, if anyone's thinking of coming up to me after the show and saying, have you tried meditation, I'll headbutt you. Because people say that all the time and they know you have anxiety. It's like, have you tried all that happens when I try to meditate is I get anxious that I'm meditating wrong. And it's like the little voice in my head just goes, oh, you're having some quiet time. Are you? Oh, well, let's go through all the shit things you've ever said and done in your life, shall we? And that's all that happens. I can't quieten my brain. So I've learned that my way of dealing with it is I have to keep it occupied.
Yeah.
But
it's that weird thing, I guess, when you're on stage and you start thinking about how weird it is as you're on stage, which doesn't happen all that often because you don't. But when it does happen, it's really fucking freaky.
Yeah.
I just started thinking about what we're doing now, and it's freaking. These people have paid to come
see
us talk.
I used to be I used to watch Fist of Fun. You know, I remember going to Edinburgh Festival in 1995 and watching your show with Stu. And now I'm fucking sad. How the fuck did this happen? You know, and I have to do that all the time. I'm sort of pinching myself and just going, well, that happened. Like, it's Mark Steele lives in Brighton.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got to become good mates with him and sort of, but every now and then you're like, well, I used to buy tickets and go watch your shows and now we're having a Sunday lunch. You know, he came to my house on Christmas Day. Like, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah, fuck off, Mark, it's Christmas.
Yeah, he won't leave me alone, bitch, help.
I'll get rid of him.
He's in my house right now.
But yeah, it's freaky thing. All of it's pretty freaky.
Yeah.
I don't think it's really happening. I think. Do you ever think that you're already like very old and in you've got dementia and you're in a home?
Yeah.
And maybe the stuff you're thinking, maybe it did happen or maybe it didn't happen. But you know, there's no way of knowing. That déjà vu could be just a little bit in your brain going, "This has happened already. You've lived this one." Ah, shut up. Be all right, wouldn't it, if that was it?
The thing is, if I'm feeling it now, I don't care. You know, there's all sorts of theories out there where we're in some sort of computer simulation, and you go, great, I'm having a nice time in it, so crack on.
I think that's true. I don't think it can be. When you think of the chances of being alive, they're so small.
Yeah.
I mean, not just even like your sperm making the egg.
But my sperm?
Yeah.
Infinitesimal.
The sperm that you were before you were joined together with an egg, that sperm meeting that egg, 600 million to one just for that,
Your parents had to have sex. It sounds that they weren't very...
Well, I say, which for my parents is hard to imagine.
But, you know, they had to have sex at that exact moment and that exact sperm had to get through. And then that's all the way through history and all the chances where, you know, it's just impossible that we're
here. Is anyone else having an existential crisis?
It's impossible.
Right now? It's a really good conversation for a girl with anxiety.
So, therefore, we can only be like characters in a computer game. The only thing that makes sense. And we're living in the, you know, sort of the best time to be alive as a human being. We haven't had to go through all the shit that the pretend people in the computer game had to go through to get here. You know, we've got these luxurious lives.
Yeah.
Even with the levels of anxiety we have, it's still nothing like that a tiger might come and bite my head off any minute. Yeah. Could still happen. Watch out. Yeah, so it's, none of this is real. So that's fine. So don't worry
about it.
Doesn't
matter then, does it?
None of it matters.
Nothing matters.
Nothing matters. And, you know, things happen, you think, yeah, this is the kid who's playing this game deliberately fucking thing. Like Brexit, Trump. The kid's just got bored. He's like, what if we do... I play Civilization. Occasionally I'd nuclear bomb Birmingham just to see what happens. That's a kid just doing that, isn't it? See what happens. Ah, yeah, it fucks it up for them. I don't care. Hey. Got my proper life, but then is he in a video game as well? He hasn't thought about that, has he? And then he's a video game making us a video game, and where does it end? And then it's not, yeah... Interesting, isn't it? I've blown your mind, haven't I, mate? Blown you, you never thought anything. What if you're the only real human and everyone else is robots, mate? You never thought that, have you? How about that? It'd be good, wouldn't it? You could fuck them. Sorry, I went off on a... Another... Well, this is an interesting talk show. Goodness, time's flying by.
God, I go on, don't I?
No, it's gone. It goes terrifyingly fast, which again makes me think it's a video game. there's no way the 45 minutes has passed. You wrote an article for The Guardian about a few years ago, which got a lot of publicity about not seeing ugly people on TV and or people who are deemed unattractive and putting yourself in that camp.
Help was I wrote the article. So it was basically about how, you know, ugliness being portrayed on TV and is not ugly. You know, Ugly Betty was not ugly. She was just wearing glasses. And how you don't see people that look like me. It's a really hard conversation to have because I ended up in hospital when I was younger because I had such crippling low self-esteem and particularly about the way I looked that it doesn't matter whether you objectively think I'm ugly or not. That doesn't matter. It's what's in here that matters, right? And I genuinely believe that I was hideous. You know, when I was properly ill, I used to apologise to people on public transport for having to look at me. I mean, I was ill. And my point was that you don't see... It's not that sort of dysmorphia. It's not helped by the fact that everyone, you're being told that these people are ugly when they're clearly not, you know, and that the full range of people aren't represented. And you know, there's lots of people doing good work in that area now, like Jamila Jamil, and, you know, it's brilliant. But this was in 2013, I wrote this article, and it was off the back of a few things that had happened. And of course, people just read what they, you know, into it. So it was seen as me sort of somehow trying to get people to tell me I'm pretty. Which, you know, was fundamentally misunderstanding the whole gist of the article. Or, you know, then people are complaining that I wasn't ugly enough. You know, you can't win. You really can't. So, and obviously, it's just about representation and it's just about, you know, everything's about, you have to see it to be it, you know, and that's why now, suddenly, we've got loads of women are doing comedy and it's brilliant because they're seeing it on their screens at last. They're seeing it in their comedy clubs at last, which even 10 years ago, when I started, I was still, for the first 5 years, was only ever the only woman on the bill. Yeah. You know, whereas now that's changing. And so more women are at home watching Mot the Week and going, oh, look, they've got two now. Fucking hell, I can do this. it's all part of that representation thing. But yeah, I got a lot of shit for it.
It's really interesting. I remember seeing, you know, if you watch like old TV shows, I remember seeing like an old, I can't remember what it was about, but there was an old like arts discussion program. It might have been about Life of Brian or something like that, but it was like academics discussing stuff. And what it is, it's just normal people. It's normal people who aren't the identikit, pretty or handsome You know, there are more ugly men on TV than there are ugly women.
Oh, yeah.
But thank God for that. I still have a chance. But you know, it was just sort of shocking to see regular people with, like, you know, the academics from the 1970s who weren't, you know, doing their hair and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And who had slightly squidgy faces or, you know, looked a bit weird in some ways. But they were actually just normal people. They don't look weird. And they don't look weird when you go out and look at the members of the public in front of us. I mean, look at these.
Yeah, Christ.
Guys. Or just walk down the street, you know. And so that's weird, the way your brain, one's brain has flipped to such an extent that it almost seems funny to see someone who looks normal on TV.
On TV, yeah.
Rather than thinking, isn't it fucking weird that we only see one type of person on TV? Clearly, it's not a job that's, you know... It's nice if you look nice, but it's not down to looking nice.
No, and also there is such a gender divide in it that, you know, Piers Morgan proves you don't have to be pretty to be on TV. But you do if you're a woman, you know, and it's that older man, younger woman partnership that goes, you know, throughout history. It's just not seeing yourself represented. There's certain TV jobs I've been told I'm too old for at 42, you know. And I think, well... That's all very well, but 20-year-olds aren't watching telly.
No, exactly.
My mum's watching telly, so who's representing her? You know, how many women in this? My mum's 60, she'll be 69, wait, next month. I don't know why I did that so much.
Do you think you have to spend the whole of that year just going, I'm 69, wait, wait,
wait. See, I'm my dad's daughter. I kind of, it's in there somewhere, the genes. And, you know, she's active, she has a good social life and that. Where's her on telly?
Yeah.
You know, if I'm too old, then what's for her?
But again, I think that's interesting because I think the TV people are so stupid about it. They haven't realised that they essentially are in a dead medium.
Well, they're trying to capture the youth and the youth aren't interested.
But they need, you know, they're actually, there's this huge, as Brexit shows, there is a huge audience.
They're ignoring.
For other people. Yeah, so it's, you know, it's kind of crazy that's the case. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, not that YouTube is any better in this. We self-selected, though. That's what's sort of interesting. And that's why, you know, if there is a programme or a film that is represented the way you want to be represented, then you've got to support that thing, you know, because actually everything in this business is run by the money of it, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you stop going to see a certain type of film or person... or comedian or whatever, and start seeing a different one, then that will become popular.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, economics at the end of the day. And another thing I want to talk to you about, again, another slightly, another serious subject, was the work you've done with the Getting Home...
The Home Safe Collective. Home Safe, yeah. Well, that was... must be about a year ago now, maybe just over a year ago, a comedian was in Melbourne, Eurydice Dixon was going home from she was a sort of open mic comedian just starting out her career in Melbourne, and was walking home after a gig one night and was raped and murdered on her way home from the gig. And, you know, people ask why women don't do comedy, and I think one of the things that puts a lot of women off is that we spend a lot of time traveling about late at night, getting night buses. For the first 6 years I was on the circuit, I couldn't drive. I didn't have a car. And, you know, I lived in London for a large chunk of that. So you'd have a gig in Yorkshire somewhere and you'd get a lift back to London, and I'd get dumped on the outskirts of London and have to make my way back to Crystal Palace at 3 a.m, you know. And it just didn't seem fair that we were, you know... even now I've got a car, very often it's in a multi-story car park that by the time I finish my show I come out and it's deserted and I'm having to go back to the car on my own. Or and there's all these journeys that you make and you have to weigh up in your head, you know, I really want this job, I want to do it, and I want to be I don't want to make a fuss, because if you make a fuss people don't book you, because the thing about comedy is there's a million people in the line behind you to do every job you've got, so you don't want to make a fuss, you know. And then by not making a fuss, things don't get better and don't improve and people don't realise there's an issue. And then when that happens to Eurydice, there's a large sort of WhatsApp group of female comics. We all sort of chat to each other and support each other. And we were like, well, it's amazing, really, this hadn't happened before, because we are often putting ourselves in these positions. And so the first thing that happened was we started talking to promoters after it happened, because then you had concrete, like, look, this has happened to someone now. We need to be careful. And so more and more promoters, and it wasn't that they didn't care, it's just it hadn't occurred to them, because most of the promoters are men.
Yeah.
You know, who it doesn't bother them in the same way. So most, you know, lots of promoters now will get you a taxi back to the hotel, or, you know, walk, get someone to make sure they walk you to the station or to your car or whatever. It's just little things like that make such a big difference. Or, and I found other comics on the bill will now ask, you know, are you all right getting home? Whereas before, they just want to get off and, you know, which is fine, I'd get it, but now they just weren't aware. And the one place where we talked a lot about was at the Edinburgh Festival. You know, when you're starting out as a comic, Edinburgh is extremely expensive to go and do the Edinburgh Fringe. People often don't realise that if they're not performers, that, you know, you pay a fortune for accommodation, for to get there, for your venue, to, you know, it takes a long time till you start making money in Edinburgh. And so, and the shows go on, the bars are open until 5 a.m, the shows go on that late. And if you're an open spot comedian who's trying to make it, trying to get the stage time, you don't want to turn down anything, because you don't want to be the person that said no, because they might not ask you again. Mm. And so very often in Edinburgh, I would find myself walking home across the meadows at 2 a.m, you know, with my keys between my fingers going, this doesn't feel safe. But not wanting to make a fuss. And so we decided, after what happened to Eurydice, we decided we need to do something to make sure that no one has to make that decision. And the Edinburgh Festival is the one place where we could do that. Because unfortunately, I can't do it for every city in every country. But in Edinburgh has a huge amount of comics descend upon Edinburgh. And I wanted to make sure that no one ever has to go, I really want to do that gig, so fuck it, I'm going to make this unsafe journey. So we set up a fund, and we called it Home Safe Collective, and we just took donations, so anyone could donate if they wanted to. We weren't pressuring anyone to donate. And we raised about £5,000. And so we put that money in a taxi fund in Edinburgh. So we chose a taxi company in Edinburgh where all their drivers are police checked. And we put the money in that fund, and we set up a system whereby if you are a vulnerable... Well, the way we phrased it, and again, we got shit for this because you can't please everyone at the moment. But, well, A, we got shit because the press in Scotland started saying that we were suggesting that Edinburgh was unsafe. Right. Which, you know, where's safe, for fuck's sake? You know, murders don't just happen. Anyway, that's a whole other... So we had to, at that point, go, right, we're not doing any press, because they were just twisting it. So then we did like a registration system for female performers. We sort of got the word out there by word of mouth, really, in performer forums and things. And we said it was for women, non-binary people, people who identify as women. And the other thing that we said was anyone who feels vulnerable. So we weren't saying it wasn't for men. You know, if you're a man and you feel vulnerable going home, we were not going to stop you signing up. But of course, then it was all like, oh, you don't give a shit, men get attacked too. You know, it's like, this is not what we're... You know, again, that willful misunderstanding of you trying to do a good thing. And but we set it up, and it was a real success. We loads of people used it, and didn't abuse it, which was the other thing we were worried about, that people would take the opportunity to take cabs everywhere and charge it. And we were willing to take that collateral damage, really. We thought, well, if it means one person gets home safely where they wouldn't, we'll take the hit.
Yeah.
But people were really... And also the other thing is, you know, a lot of people didn't want to sign up because they said, well, I can afford a taxi. It's like, yeah, but what if you're out one night and your purse gets nicked, or, you know, you've forgotten to bring your... You still can be vulnerable if you've got money. So, you know, still use the service and just pop it back in the donations the next day if you feel bad about using it. Yeah. We wanted everyone to sign up. And, it was used, and hopefully just made people feel a bit safer. We will never know whether it actually stopped anything happening, but as long as people feel safer, that's enough for me. Sure. And then we won the Edinburgh Awards. People gave us the panel prize for setting it up, which was, and the prize was £5,000, which means we now have the money to do it again this year.
Brilliant. Just have to just keep winning the award and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting, but, you know, that's the kind of thing that they should pay for that every year. That this, the awards.
Yeah, I mean, Melbourne Comedy Festival, obviously it was Melbourne where it happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And this year Melbourne Comedy Festival announced they've set up their own...
Yeah.
Similar scheme.
That's brilliant.
And I think, you know, chatting to Nika Burns, who sort of produces the Edinburgh Fringe, she was very keen, I think, A, for us to have that money so that we didn't have to fundraise for it. And I think, going forward next year and the year after, we'll probably set something up with the Fringe.
Yeah.
To make sure it's not just, you know... Because the other thing is, when you're trying to do a show in Edinburgh, trying to do the admin for that at the same time, and, you know, it was actually quite a lot that we took on. So if we can make that a thing that sort of runs itself for the future, then, you know, That'd be great.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Well done. Fantastic work. Right, well, we won't finish on that note of you being seeming like a nice person. Find something else to pull apart. Are you going to be doing Edinburgh again this year?
I'm not going this year. No. That's why I'm so relaxed right now. No, I'm not. I've decided to have a year out. I'll be going back next year.
Okay.
So I'll do sort of 2 years on, 1 year off. It's my kind of pattern at the moment.
That's probably a good idea.
I did about
13 in a row. That was a mistake.
I did my show in 2017. I meant to tell you this. I don't know if I did tell you. I did a show called Fortitude because I turned 40.
Yes.
What I really wanted to call it was, oh, fuck, I'm the age Richard Herring was when he did Oh, Fuck, I'm 40. But my agent was like, anyone under 30 is not going to know what you're banging on about.
Yeah, it's 40s. It's not as bad as 50. No, it's.
I love being in my 40s.
Yeah,
because I do think the pressure's off. Like, no one. People have stopped asking me when I'm going to have kids. Brilliant. Yeah. They just assume I can't now. Great, if that's what they want to think. Fine. And you sort of get to your 40s. You are the person you're going to be. You're not constant. You know, still sort of going, well, who will I end up as? You're like, oh, what, this is it. And I'm also, like, with Brexit and Trump and the rise of the far right and all of that going on, I'm not quite glad I'm near the end. Do you know what I mean? Like, fuck being a teenager now. Social media and the world, no, fuck that. I had some of the good times. It's good.
So you're feeling happy? I mean, you've settled in Brighton. You've bought a place in Brighton with your partner.
Yeah, yeah.
And I say that in Brighton just in case, you know.
It's a man, but yeah.
Okay, right. There are no homosexuals anywhere else, certainly not where I live. No, in Hertfordshire, we don't have them in Hertfordshire. I think there might have been one in London. Do you think being settled and happy is good as a comedian or bad as a comedian?
Well, I worried about it, to be honest, because, you know, so much of my shtick was about being a loser in love and being single and all of those things. And I remember my agent saying, when she went, oh, fuck, you're in love, aren't you? You know, like, oh, yeah. And, but actually, luckily, my fella gives me a lot to work with. and he doesn't mind me talking about our relationship and stuff. Yeah, I mean, I am settled in a way. We've just got a puppy, you know, so...
He did a little Valentine's Day thing with Cryptic
Crossword Clues. That was so funny. Last year he was away snowboarding on Valentine's Day. Wow. And he's really not a romantic type at all. But he left me on a dressing table in the bedroom. He just left me what I thought was just a card. And I opened it. And because we're both nerds, we love cryptic crosswords. And he'd left me a cryptic treasure hunt around the flat and he'd hidden my present in a thing. And I was so, because he's not a big gesture kind of guy. It was so out of character. I was really moved by it. Really. And so I took photos of it and like tweeted about it. And it sort of went a bit viral. And he's up a mountain. He had no idea. And he was just getting texts from his friends going, thanks a lot, mate. Show us right up. Like, there were like magazine articles in the States about it, you know. And it was amazing.
You only do one thing like that, fellas, in your life, and that's it. You're set. So
yeah, that's it.
Just think of, you have to think of your own one. For me, it was Ferrero Rocher chocolates. That worked for me. Never have to do anything again.
But you know, he did it again this year.
Did he?
But he was there this year, and it was Valentine's Day was like 2 days after I'd done my burns, and so I was feeling really sorry for myself. Right. So, but if he does it again next year, I'm going to be like, I'll think of something new, mate. Come on.
And what's coming up next for you? Anything exciting in the pipeline?
I'm on tour at the minute.
Yep.
So touring my show Rose Tinted all around the place. So yeah, my website, have a look on that if you want to come along. I'm doing Brighton in October. Just same old Mock the Week coming up.
Yep.
Yeah, and see what happens.
Fantastic. Well, I'm really glad things are going so well for you. Phenomenon. Ladies and gentlemen, she's one of yours, Angela Vance. Thank you very much. You've been lovely. Thanks for having me. I'll be there. I'll be in there in a sec. Thank you very much. How'd you like them sky potatoes?
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.